Hi, Dave Emery here. This is For the Record program number 974, Operation Mind Control, Part 1, Creating or Programming Perfect Killers. This is being recorded on September 4th of the year 2017. I'm about to begin my 39th year on the air, and because of that, and because of the fact that these programs are hierarchical in a sense, they build on material that has been in earlier shows, and in light of the fact that the vast bulk of what I have done over those now almost 38 plus years is on the SpitfireList.com website, archived for future reference. It is difficult to assess whether, or past point, how many listeners or dedicated listeners who have downloaded or listened to the archives over the years and or read the material, and how many of them are younger listeners who may be listening to some of my discussions about mind control cults. We spoke about the Unification Church of Sun Myung Moon in, for the record, 957 or 960. Actually, I guess that was 969 and 970, dealing with the reemergence of Japanese fascism. We've also spoken about the Saniketan Park Association and the Hare Krishna cult in connection with, respectively, Julian Assange and Tulsi Gabbard, representative from Hawaii. I think in order perhaps to strengthen the foundation of the programs for newer and younger listeners who necessarily may not have been exposed to a lot of this information, we're going to go back into the archives and review some key elements of information about the intelligence community's mind control programs, this by way of fleshing out information people are going to need to know. We're going to go back, first of all, to September of 1984, more than 30 years ago, and we're going to listen to a couple of excerpts from AFA number 5, and in turn, these excerpts come from the book Operation Mind Control by the late Walter Bowert, or Bowert, as I have also heard his name spoken. We're going to begin with some information that was presented by a Dr. Narus, a Navy physician, and discusses his work programming perfect assassins for the military. Following that is a tale of a fellow named Luis Angel Castillo, C-A-S-T-I-L-L-O, who appears to have been a mind control assassin who may have been involved in the assassination of JFK.
Now, one question that has consistently come up and is the fact that is the question of whether or not someone can be hypnotized to perform an action which they would not normally do. Many critics who have suggested that mind control is impossible have cited the allegation that someone cannot be hypnotized into doing something they would not ordinarily do as a means of rebutting the notion that mind control is possible. Well, we're going to be going to read you a section now from a book called Operation Mind Control. Operation Mind Control was published in softcover by Dell Books, and it's authored by Walter Bowert, B-O-W-A-R-T. As I said, published by Dell Books, copyrighted 1978. And what Bowert points out here is the fact that although someone might not be able, to be hypnotized into doing something, say shooting someone that they would, that they like, say someone would not even under hypnosis be, could not be convinced to shoot someone that they normally held in high regard, they most definitely could be convinced under hypnosis that this person is in fact somebody else who they would shoot, and then the person will go ahead and shoot them. And that's important to remember. You may not be able to be hypnotized into shooting your mother, but you could be convinced that that your mother was in fact someone else who you would be quite willing to shoot, and who you would then go ahead and shoot. Again, reading from Operation Mind Control, Walter Bowert, copyrighted 1978. In 1947, J.G. Watkins induced criminal behavior in deeply hypnotized subjects during an army experiment. Watkins suggested a distorted view of reality to his subjects by inducing hallucinations, which allowed them to avoid direct conflict with their own moral concepts. He carefully chose his suggestions to be in line with his subjects' pre-existing motivational structures, and so was able to induce so-called antisocial behavior. Watkins took a normal, healthy army private, a young man whose tests indicated a most stable personality, and put him in a deep trance. Though merely striking a superior officer is a court-martial offense in the army, Watkins wanted to see if he could get his subject to strangle a high-ranking officer. After the subject was deep into trance, Watkins told him that the officer sitting across from him was a Japanese soldier who was trying to kill him. Interrupting, keep in mind this is 1947, right after World War II. He must kill or be killed, Watkins suggested. And immediately the private leapt ferociously at the officer and grabbed him by the throat. In his waking state, the private would have been aghast at the thought of trying to strangle a superior officer. But under hypnosis, believing the officer was a dangerous Japanese soldier, the young private had to be pulled off his superior by three husky assistants. The officer came within a hair's breadth of being strangled, as the young man was most persistent in his attempt to kill what he regarded as the enemy. Watkins repeated this experiment with other subjects. The second time, he used two officers who were good friends. One of them was given the hypnotic suggestion that the other was a Japanese soldier and that he must kill or be killed. The man who had received the command not only made a powerful lunge at his friend, but as he did, he whipped out and opened a concealed jackknife, which neither the doctor, his assistants, nor his friend knew he had. Only the quick action of one of his assistants, who was a judo expert, prevented a potentially fatal stabbing. In both cases, reality was so distorted that the subjects took murderous and antisocial action. If they had accomplished their defensive acts, unquote, both men could have been convicted of murder, since the law did not recognize motivation through hypnosis as a fact. The courts, in all but a few cases, had adopted the traditional scientific view that criminal behavior cannot be induced under hypnosis. That view still stands today. To test the premise, which was then widely held, that a normal person under hypnotic trance could not be made to divulge information which would be self-incriminating, Watkins conducted a number of experiments where a monetary bribe was offered to withhold information. Watkins discovered that, quote, when placed in a trance, they spilled every time, either verbally or in writing. The subject of one of these experiments was an enlisted WAC in military intelligence. Her commanding officer ordered her not to reveal a list of what were made to appear to be real military secrets. Under hypnosis, she spilled everything. So basically, summing up here, this fellow J.G. Watkins, first of all, hypnotized a soldier into believing that his superior officer was a Japanese soldier, whom he then proceeded to try to strangle. He then hypnotized him to think that one of his friends, an actual friend of his, was a Japanese soldier. A different fellow then pulled out a knife and attempted to kill his friend. And apparently people who were conditioned to not disclose information could be induced under hypnosis to spill all of that information. So again, keep in mind that it is possible to get someone to think that reality is other than what it really is and act on the basis of a false concept. And that is how someone can be hypnotized into doing something that they would not do when in a normal state of consciousness.
All right, continuing from Bord's book on a new chapter and on a rather interesting series of revelations of fairly recent vintage. This is just starting at the beginning of Bord's book, Chapter 11, A School for Assassins. The author writes as follows. The cryptocracy, and by the cryptocracy, Bord is referring to the people at the top of various intelligence groups interested in this sort of secretive behavior in terms of experimental mind control. So he's using it as a generic term. It doesn't have any specific significance to any specific people. The cryptocracy recruited their assassins from among people who had already demonstrated a violent nature, people who had few reservations about taking human life. No homicidal maniacs were recruited because they could not be controlled. The cryptocracy needed killers who would not murder on impulse, but only upon command. Once selected, the assassin candidates were turned over to the military, where, under the guise of, quote, combat readiness training, they underwent a complete program of conditioning. Graduates of the program would forever after act with ruthless efficiency. They would eliminate local political leaders in a foreign country, or undertake search and destroy missions in violation of national and international laws. They would be given the cover that would allow them to enter the foreign service, or they would pose as embassy marine guards. In July 1975, the Sunday Times in London quoted a U.S. Navy psychologist who admitted that U.S. naval intelligence, and I just interrupting for a moment, you'll remember that U.S. naval intelligence was one of the groups earlier that was funding Delgado's research, as well as other mind control research. The U.S. Navy psychologist who admitted that U.S. naval intelligence had taken convicted murderers from military prisons, conditioned them as political assassins, and then placed them in American embassies around the world. This admission came shortly after the Senate Intelligence Committee had scolded the CIA for plotting a number of political assassinations around the world. From the congressional reports, however, one got the feeling that the cryptocracy was being chastised not for the assassinations it had successfully accomplished, but for those which it had attempted but failed. The attempts on the life of Fidel Castro drew the greatest notice from the congressional committees and the press. According to the Sunday Times story, naval psychologist Lieutenant Commander Thomas Narutt, N-A-R-U-T, was assigned to the U.S. Regional Medical Center at Naples, Italy. When he first made public the Navy's part in programming assassins, he was attending a NATO conference in Oslo on dimensions of stress and anxiety. In attendance at that conference were 120 psychologists of all descriptions and from many countries. Many of them were involved in research on how to improve man's ability to cope with stress, but none of them felt compelled, as Narutt did, to discuss their work so fully or so frankly. The stated objective of the conference was to exchange information on how soldiers and people in difficult jobs could cope with stress. Dr. Narutt's talk was on, quote, the use of a symbolic model and verbal intervention in inducing and reducing stress. His speech began with a plug for the Navy. He knew, he said, that many of the scientists present had often encountered problems in their purely scientific research because of the military's inclination to research that would yield quick and useful results. He sympathized with those who had trouble getting subjects, funds, or both out of the military for their purely scientific research. But things were different in the Navy, he said. In the Navy, Narutt bragged, there were plenty of captive personnel who could be used as guinea pigs. In the Navy, there was a computerized record of each man's background and psychological profile, so that a quick selection of men with suitable psychological inclinations for experiments could be made. Navy psychologists not only had access to computerized records, but also to psychological tests and background data on a large number of people. In the Navy, Narutt said, funds were plentiful and there were no problems with transporting subjects for study to nearly any place in the world. Narutt stated proudly that the U.S. Navy provided scientists with the most advanced research facilities in the world. A Canadian psychologist at the conference later remarked, Narutt's message was loud and clear, join the Navy and study the world. In his brief discourse, Dr. Narutt did no more than hint at the work he had been doing in teaching, quote, combat readiness units to cope with the stress of killing. Later, however, during private questioning with a small group of listeners, reporter Peter Watson of the Sunday Times, a former psychologist among them, Narutt in full unfolded the amazing story of the Navy's programming of assassins on an assembly line basis. In his mid-30s, Dr. Narutt had just completed his doctoral dissertation on the question of whether certain films provoke anxiety, and whether forcing a man to do irrelevant tasks while watching violent films would help him cope with the anxiety they produced. When pressed by Watson to explain the details of this kind of conditioning, Narutt said that he had worked with, quote, combat readiness units, which included men being programmed for commando-type operations and for undercover placement at U.S. embassies. These, Narutt said, were, quote, hitmen and assassins, Narutt's own words, made ready to kill in selected countries should the need arise. Dr. Alfred Zitani, an American delegate to the conference, was very surprised by Narut's disclosure. Quote, "Do you think Dr. Narut realizes what he has just said?" Zitani asked. "That kind of information must be classified."
The conditioning of Narut's assassins was accomplished by audio-visual desensitization, a standard behavior modification process. These men were desensitized, unquote, to mayhem by being shown films of people being killed or injured in a number of different ways. At first, the films would show only mild forms of bloodshed. As the men became acclimated to the scenes of carnage, they would see progressively more violent scenes. The assassin candidates, Narut explained, would eventually be able to dissociate any feelings they might have from even the goriest scenes they viewed. Narut said that, of course, U.S. naval psychologists would have first selected the candidates for training by their psychological makeup. Those selected for assassination assignments were often from submarine crews and paratroops. Others were convicted murderers from military prisons who had already shown a proclivity for violence. Still others were men who had been given awards for valor. World War II Medal of Honor winner Audie Murphy was a subject of extensive research. The best killers, according to Narut, were men whom psychologists would classify as passive-aggressive, unquote, personalities. These were people with strong drives that were usually kept under tight control. Such types were usually calm, but from time to time would exhibit outbursts of temper during which they could literally kill without remorse. Narut said that through psychological testing, he and his colleagues were looking for more such men for further conditioning. Among the tests used by the Navy to determine violent natures was the Minnesota Multiphasic Personality Inventory, which is used widely by educators and businessmen to determine psychological qualities of students and employees. The tests consist of hundreds of questions designed to measure such personality traits as hostility, depression, and psychopathy. According to Narut, the men selected by the tests or by evidence of past violence were taken for programming to the Navy's Neuropsychiatric Laboratory in San Diego, California, or to the Naples Medical Center, which employed Dr. Narut. Audiovisual desensitization was the major technique used in programming the assassins. Psychological indoctrination completed the programming by instilling the desired prejudicial attitudes. The audiovisual desensitization began with the subject strapped into a chair with his head clamped so that he could not look away from the screen. A special mechanism prevented the subject's eyelids from closing. The candidate was then shown a film of an African youth being crudely circumcised by fellow members of his tribe. The youth was circumcised with a blunt knife, painfully, and without anesthetic. This well-known film is used widely in psychological experiments to create stress. Afterwards, the candidate was asked about details of what he had seen. He was asked, for example, to describe the color of the belt on the doctor's trousers or the motif on the handle of the knife that cut off the foreskin. The next film showed a man in a sawmill where planks were sliced from huge logs. In the operation of the saw, the man slipped and cut off his fingers. As the films progressed in gruesomeness, the reactions of the candidate were measured by sensing devices. Heartbeat, breathing rate, and brain waves were recorded, very much as on a polygraph. That, of course, is a lie detector interrupting here. If the physiological responses, which might have been great in the beginning, slowed down and resumed normal patterns as the more bloodthirsty scenes were viewed, the candidates were judged to have completed this stage of conditioning.
Continuing on with Boert's Operation Mind Control, the last phase of conditioning, Narut said, was to indoctrinate the candidates to think of their potential enemies as inferior forms of life. By this stage, the candidates would have already been selected for assignment to particular countries. They would be shown films and given lectures which portrayed the customs and cultural habits of the foreign countries in a biased fashion. The people of those countries would be portrayed as enemies of the United States and were always spoken of in demeaning terms. They were often presented as if they were, quote, less than human. Their customs were ridiculed, and local leaders were presented as evil demagogues, even if they were legitimate political figures. According to Dr. Narut, it took only a few weeks to indoctrinate susceptible candidates by this process. Those who were not susceptible to the conditioning were dropped earlier in the program and returned to other assignments. Narod admitted that he did not have the necessary, quote, need to know as to where all the programmed men were sent, although at one point in his conversation with Peter Watson, Narod specified that programmed assassins have been installed in the Athens embassy. He said that his busiest time was when a large group of men went through such training towards the end of 1973, at the time of the Yom Kippur War. After the Oslo conference interview, Watson returned to London to file his story. Watson is the reporter for the Times and a former psychologist himself. Watson returned to London to file his story. Writing up the details, he found a few points which needed clarification, but he could not reach Narod either at his home or in his laboratory in Naples. Watson then asked the U.S. Embassy in London to comment on the information Narod had volunteered. The embassy passed the buck to the U.S. Navy. Within a few days, the Pentagon issued a categorical denial that the U.S. Navy had ever, quote, engaged in psychological training or other types of training of personnel as assassins. Quote, they also denied that any such training had ever taken place either in San Diego or in Naples. They said they, too, had been unable to contact Lieutenant Commander Narod, but they did confirm that he was on the staff of the U.S. Regional Medical Center in Naples as a psychologist. But Dr. Zitani later offered to testify about what Narod had told him to, quote, appropriate authorities. Watson was also to approach later by a psychologist in Los Angeles who said he had seen the Pentagon denials, so thought Watson would like to know that he had lent the San Diego psychologist a copy of his film on circumcision, which was used in the desensitization conditioning. A few days later, Narod was located. He flew to London to discuss the matter, ostensibly with Watson's paper, the Sunday Times, but instead he held a press conference, saying only that he had been talking in, quote, theoretical and not practical terms. He then flew back to the Naples base. After his return to Naples, U.S. Naval Headquarters in London offered the official explanation for Narod's statement. Narod had, quote, personal problems. A few days later, Watson was able to contact Narod at the U.S. hospital in Naples, but he refused to elaborate on his disclosure. During the Oslo conference interview, Narod had said several times that what he was saying about the assassins was, quote, coming out anyway. He was referring to the congressional disclosures about CIA assassination plots. But the fact that the Navy had been operating along lines similar to the CIA was not known to the public, nor has it subsequently been admitted. The details of the story that Lieutenant Commander Narod related have been strongly and categorically denied in all subsequent queries of the Navy. So, looking back, there's a variety of interesting things in the Narod story. Some of this we're not going to have time to cash in on tonight in terms of bringing up supporting documentation that goes with it. But the ascending series of desensitizations. Now you notice in this there isn't even any mention of use of drugs or anything else. So this is either possibly a different type of training, or it's possible that those details were omitted, or that that's a later stage of conditioning, or something like that. It's possible, as they mentioned, that this Dr. Narod did not have need to know authority to see the whole operation all the way through. Anyway, it touches on some other interesting things that we've seen in other places that we may have time to talk about later on.
Again, the processes involved here are very, very common processes, which anybody who's ever studied psychology in any university in the United States would be familiar with. First of all, the Minnesota Multiphasic Personality Inventory is something which probably a lot of you have taken. It's a very commonly used test, and it's administered in institutions of all kinds, okay? The desensitization process, audiovisual desensitization, is also, as indicated, a very, very common technique. There's been a lot of research in classical psychology tests about eliminating phobias using that precise technique. Well, in this case, in a sense, a phobia, namely the phobia of extreme physical violence, is what is being removed. Note also that the people are already inclined in that direction, the people selected as candidates for this thing. I think it's also worth noting that despite what I think one could regard as the pro forma denials of the Navy, the source for this information is the London Times. It's one of the most respected newspapers in the world. It's also quite conservative. Many people think, for example, the New York Times, which has a liberal reputation, the London Times is a pretty conservative and very respectable newspaper, so this is not National Enquirer affair. And Narut's story, by the way, has been printed in a lot of other publications. Now, keep in mind that Delgado's work, for example, was funded by the Office of Naval Research. It's, again, not only was the CIA involved in developing mind control techniques, and specifically mind control techniques to perform assassination, but the military as well. And keep all of that in front of you. You know, remember all of that as we go through this. And again, go back and put some of these details together. But as with RHIC, in which the commonly used technique of post-hypnotic blocking, the technique of conditioning, in this case, a Pavlovian conditioning was used. Operant conditioning can also be used in certain certain methods of having people commit assassination. The difference between those can be discussed in a phone-in session if you'd like. But again, the techniques that are involved here are very, very common and would certainly be familiar to anyone with even a relatively elementary knowledge of academic psychology. Now, keep in mind Lincoln Lawrence's account, basically, of mind control being used in the assassination of President Kennedy. We're going to go back to a CIA assassin. Now, we're going to read you an entire chapter from Bowert's book, and this is almost certainly the most detailed and complete account of the functioning of a mind control assassin ever presented. And because of that, we're going to read you the entire chapter unedited so that basically you'll have all of the information at your disposal and can go back and check it out. And I think, again, the time during which mind control has been in effect is worth taking note of here. The techniques which we were talking about with RHICEDOM were fully operational by the mid-1960s. Mind control zombie couriers were testified, their existence circa World War II was testified by William Stevenson, a very high-ranking British intelligence agent, in fact, in charge of all British intelligence in the Americas during World War II. So keep in mind, now the fellow we're going to be talking about here, a fellow named Luis Angel Castillo, was basically the events we're about to describe here, or rather that Bowert relates in Operation Mind Control, occurred in 1967, okay, almost 20 years ago. And note the degree of sophistication here in the conditioning. Now, Bowert titles this chapter The Four Faces of a Zombie, and it begins. On March 2nd, 1967, 24-year-old Luis Angel Castillo was arrested by the Philippine National Bureau of Investigation, the NBI, on suspicion of conspiring to assassinate President Ferdinand Marcos in Manila. In a series of interrogation sessions, the NBI and the Philippine Army investigators gave him truth serum at his request and put him under hypnosis. During one of these sessions, Castillo revealed that he had been involved in an assassination 4 years earlier. Castillo told the NBI, both under hypnosis and truth serum, and also in a normal state, that he had been hypnoprogrammed to kill a man riding in an open car. Although Castillo did not know the identity of his target, the scene of his supposed hit was in Dallas, Texas. The date was November 22, 1963. After revealing this information, Castillo asked for political asylum in Manila. He was quoted in the Manila Times as saying, quote, "I am afraid to go anywhere anyway. I am as good as dead now," unquote. "I don't know how I got into Dallas and how I got out," Castillo told reporters, "but I am sure I did not carry a gun." The Manila Times story reported that Castillo had arrived in Manila carrying a Philippine passport which identified him as Antonio Reyes Elorriaga, E-L-O-R-I-A-G-A, a returning resident who had been expelled from America for overstaying his visa and stealing a car. Castillo, by the way, is C-A-S-T-I-L-L-O. While in the U.S., Castillo had traveled under the aliases Angelo Rodriguez, Razo Hernandez, Mario Rodriguez, Ignacio Gonzalez, Gradieda, and Antonio Elorriaga. Castillo told investigators that a woman with a German accent, a Mrs. Krebs, had given him his initial instructions in Dallas. According to Castillo, She was just one of many individuals who worked on him to place him in a deep hypnotic trance for the Kennedy job. Castillo said that he had been a private in the Cuban militia, the Segunda Organización Defensiva in Santiago, Cuba, when he was initially chosen for training in espionage work. He was subsequently trained for the Defensiva under a Colonel Calma, C-A-L-M-A, at a camp located about 15 miles from the Bay of Pigs. Among the members of the training cadre, Castillo said, were a communications expert named Karnovsky, along with some other Cubans and a handful of Americans. One American he identified was James Smith, who attended to Castillo's needs both as a civilian in Cuba and later in the United States. 3 years later, on October 2, 1966, Castillo was arrested in New Mexico and charged with driving without a proper auto registration. His arrest was made under the Elorriaga identity. Castillo was brought before New Mexico Justice of the Peace Elmer Bassett and sentenced to 4 days in jail. The reason I gave him a jail sentence, Bassett said, was I figured when a fellow has a hard time remembering what his name is, there's something wrong with him, unquote. After serving his sentence, Castillo was turned over to U.S. immigration authorities because he had no proof of U.S. citizenship. Bassett reported that, quote, Castillo said he was from Madison, Wisconsin, but was born in the Philippines. He couldn't show that he was from the Philippines or that he wasn't, unquote. Bassett also revealed that someone had called him a few hours after Castillo had appeared before him and asked that the man be released, unquote. I don't know who it was, Bassett said. I just told him I couldn't do that, unquote. And Niptuck will continue with the Castillo story.
According to the NBI, which again is the Philippine Bureau of Investigation, the Filipino FBI, Castillo had Antonio Elorriaga's Philippine passport on his person when he was arrested in Manila. Based on information provided by the Intelligence Service of the Philippine Armed Forces, the NBI had been searching for him since February. They had evidence that Castillo, in the guise of Elorriaga, had made contact with a guerrilla group that was constantly plotting to assassinate Marcos and overthrow the Philippine government. The NBI set to work grilling their captured suspect. They knew something of his criminal past. They knew, for example, that he had been arrested in 1962 for carrying a concealed weapon. They also knew that 2 years later he had been sentenced to a state reformatory in Bordentown, New Jersey, for larceny. But nothing prepared them for the shocking story implicating him in the events of Dallas. They asked Castillo to submit to a lie detector test, and were surprised when he said that he preferred truth serum. Suspicious of both his strange story and his behavior, NBI officials called in a psychiatrist to examine him. But even after the psychiatrist judged Castillo normal, the NBI investigators still refused to take Castillo's bizarre and contradictory story at face value. Later, reporters connected with the Manila Times were equally dumbfounded by Castillo's strange behavior. One reporter described him as, quote, a now talkative, now reticent cloak and dagger man. He clammed up when he was asked whether he was in the Philippines to help implement an assassination plot against President Marcos. In his truth serum statement, he claimed he had worked with a, quote, cell of reds, unquote, to end someone's life. But during his interview with the press, he said, quote, neither do I admit or deny it. When quizzed about Lee Harvey Oswald, he drew a blank. As a member of the Warren Commission, Gerald Ford was queried by the Philippine authorities about Castillo's revelations concerning the JFK assassination. Ford said that he would not comment on the Castillo story until he had more information. A spokesman for the Dallas Police Department said that they had no record on Castillo. Nevertheless, the U.S. Embassy did agree to a closed-door meeting between embassy officials and NBI Director Serafin Fausto on the subject of Castillo. After the meeting, Fausto refused to comment further on the story, but he did tell reporters that, quote, although publication of the story has prejudiced investigation of the case, one good thing has come out of it. Needed information is coming in from the United States to shed light on the case. Fausto also made it clear that leads obtained from the U.S. Embassy justified continuing the investigation of Castillo's link to the assassination of President Kennedy. After making an official request for assistance from the FBI, the NBI clamped a news blackout on the story and nothing further was published in the press. Private investigations later revealed that Castillo was spirited out of the Philippines, but not before a series of hypnotic sessions had taken place at the request of the FBI. The FBI wanted to have Castillo, while under hypnosis, place the time of the Kennedy assassination. They wanted to know when Castillo had come to Dallas, what time he arrived at the building, and from what location he was supposed to shoot. They wanted to know the time he left the building, the names of any people involved, and any information by which might indicate how the plot was hatched and by whom. It came as a surprise to the NBI that the FBI also wanted Castillo questioned about the Boyeros Airport, 8 miles south of Havana, Cuba. The FBI requested that the tightest possible security be kept on any testimony obtained from the hypnotic sessions. In the last of three sessions requested by the FBI, Castillo was induced into deep hypnotic trance by the ordinary talking method in an NBI interrogation room in Manila. While in that trance state, he was questioned for more than 3.5 hours. Now Dave will continue.
The hypnotist report stated, quote, "Initially, the subject indicated an admixture of desired susceptibility to hypnosynthesis, but deep-seated resistance due to the presence of a post-hypnotic block. This block appeared to have been connected with the presence, nightmarish, of a Mrs. Krebs. The total removal of this block may pave the way for maximum results," unquote. The hypnotist reported that during the pre-trance warm-up, he examined Castillo and found little scars on his forehead, chest, stomach, and fingers. Castillo told him that the scars were the result of a car accident in the U.S., which happened when some men were chasing him while he was trying to deliver, quote, "an envelope of some kind," unquote. Castillo mentioned that after the crash, he'd awakened in bandages in a hospital bed. Names which were presented to Castillo in the pre-trance interview were repeated while he was under hypnosis. He recognized the names of several individuals who were then gaining notoriety in connection with New Orleans District Attorney Jim Garrison's JFK assassination investigation, but Castillo revealed that he knew some of the people by other names. Throughout his recollections, Castillo suffered stomach cramps, said he felt a weight on his legs, unquote, and cried out in pain a number of times. Through the manipulations of the hypnotist, he was able to recall that on many different occasions he had been taken to a factory. Mrs. Krebs and Castillo had always driven to the factory in her car, and they had always entered through the front door. Castillo could not remember the exact location of the factory, other than that it was located, quote, "way outside Chicago," unquote. He spoke of a romantic relationship with Mrs. Krebs, but while one moment he spoke of her as "nice and kind," unquote, in the next breath, he said he hated her. According to the hypnotist's report, one thing was certain. Whoever Mrs. Krebs was, she, quote, "controlled the subject's activities and consciousness like a nightmare," unquote. Eliciting information from Castillo was no easy task. Over the course of many interrogations, the hypnotist discovered that Castillo could be taken to four different hypnotic levels. It appeared to the hypnotist that each level came closer to the truth. He labeled these states Zombie 1, Zombie 2, Zombie 3, and Zombie 4. Depending upon which zombie state Castillo was in, his mannerisms and identity changed. In the first state, Zombie 1, Castillo believed he was Elorriaga, and he told tales of anti-American espionage. During Zombie 2, he took on the identity of a tough-talking CIA agent in trouble. While in Zombie 3, again Castillo emerged as an agent whose cover had been blown. At this level, however, he experienced a compulsion to kill himself. On the day he was to have assassinated Marcos, Castillo responded to a program he had revealed in an earlier interrogation. He attempted suicide in his jail cell by swallowing a bottle of epoxy glue. The Zombie 4 state revealed that Castillo's true name was Manuel Angel Ramirez, a 29-year-old native of the Bronx, New York. In this state, he had no recollection of his youth except for a hazy memory of his father, who Ramirez believed was a highly placed official at the agency, unquote. As Ramirez, Castillo said that most of his life had been spent in training with or on missions for the Special Operations Group of the CIA. He remembered one training camp where he learned clandestine and martial arts. Throughout the interrogations, the theme of programmed agent, unquote, emerged. Castillo's testimony under hypnosis was that of an individual whose identity had been completely erased and reconstructed several times over. On May 30th, 1967, Castillo spontaneously went from his normal state into a zombie state. In answering Castillo's question about transfer from the hospital to jail, the hypnotist unknowingly said, quote, "That depends entirely on the big chief, you know," unquote. Upon hearing these words, a blank look came over Castillo's eyes, and all efforts to wake him were at first unsuccessful. The hypnotist then called out a series of phrases from Castillo's notebooks and found that the phrases, "I will win if I don't lose my nerve," and, quote, "I must believe myself or no one else will believe me," unquote, awakened him. And Niptuck will continue.
The next day was Castillo's birthday. The NBI planned to give him a birthday party as an excuse to get him drunk to see if his behavior changed. Castillo, it seemed, had a huge capacity for liquor. Drunk to the eyeballs, he saluted one of the NBI agents and called him Colonel. "Where do we fly tonight, Colonel?" he asked. The agent quickly told him that he was to fly the same mission as the last one. Castillo said, "Haiphong," then drunkenly fell into bed. By the way, Haiphong, of course, is the Haiphong Harbor area in North Vietnam. Castillo said, "Haiphong," then drunkenly fell into bed. He dug his fingers into his throat and vomited. He cried out for a doctor and between vomit spasms rattled out his mission to the hypnotist. He said his real name was Manuel Angel Ramirez, his rank was sergeant, and he was assigned to the Strategic Air Tactical Command in South Vietnam. He said his immediate superior was Colonel Summers. He was in Saigon in January 1966, he related, and had flown B-26 missions over Haiphong and Hanoi. He came to Manila, he said, to kill President Marcos in June, when the president would make a public speech. If his assassination attempt failed, someone else would get Marcos before the end of 1968, Castillo added. "I'm dying," he groaned and pleaded again for a doctor. He thought he was dying from a heart attack. "If I die today," he warned, "my secrets die with me." When the NBI doctor arrived, he examined Castillo and pronounced him fit, except for his obviously drunken state. He tried to give him a shot to calm him down, but Castillo protested violently. The doctor then asked him to take a pill, which he did without resistance. 2 days later, Castillo was given another medical examination by Dr. Alexis Guerrero of the NBI. A series of tests were given to measure his breathing rate, pulse rate, sweat production, and other functions. All of these tests were performed in zombie states 1, 2, and 3. The doctor noted that in each state there was a vast difference in pulse rate and assumed, because of what Castillo said and the reactions of his heart and respiration, that he was experiencing some emotional agitation. Sodium amytal was administered while he was in the zombie 3 state. According to the hypnotist, Castillo did not even notice he'd been given the injection. Soon he began to talk as he'd done previously while in the drunken state. "I'm Sergeant Manuel Ramirez of the Tactical Air Command," he said. When asked to reveal his base, he said, "You'll never know," adding, "I'm a pilot. I've flown a B-26. "The NBI are suckers," he said a little while later. "They thought they arrested me, but there I was, waiting for them to get me. I know of a great plot. I am supposed to expose it after I'm arrested. I know I will eventually return to my country." And in parentheses, the author has put the U.S. "I'll go through the motions of a trial, conviction, and jail as a criminal. After a couple of months, I will be released for my next assignment." Awakened from the zombie state, Castillo was told all about these various states and his strange behavior while in them. The hypnotist explained how he thought Castillo had been programmed. Castillo seemed baffled by this news. He said that he was not told by anybody about being programmed. He said that, quote, "Papa didn't even know about the zombie state." He grew agitated, saying that if he were in the zombie state, he might even kill Papa. And then, quote, "the agency would go to blazes. Hell will break loose on the guy responsible for the zombie," unquote. asked in a trance to identify Papa, Castillo said that he was not just a guy, but was his real father. He described him as having a mustache and smoking a pipe. He said he was the only one who could send the agency to, quote, blazes if he, Castillo, was killed on this mission. He said that Papa's initials were A.D., and that his first name was Alan. He said that he would personally tell Papa about the zombie when he got back. Well, before Dave continues, we should just state in that whether the what Castillo said was true or whether it was something that he was led to believe or not, the Papa that seems to be being identified here is fairly obviously meant to be, if it is not actually, Alan Dulles, who was, of course, the head of the CIA at that time. Of course, the initials A.D., the first name Alan, and the pipe, the mustache, the whole thing, obviously is Alan Dulles. Whether that really was him or whether this was something that Castillo was conditioned to say, well, we can discuss some of these different possibilities later on.
Okay, before continuing, you listen to KFJC Los Altos Hills. Okay, continuing now with the narrative of Castillo Ramirez, or whatever his name was, this very interesting hypno-programmed assassin. After more than 40 hypnotic sessions lasting from 1 to 5 hours each, covering the period from April 3rd to June 25th, 1967, the hypnotist reviewed the data and summarized it for the chief of the Defense Intelligence Division of the National Bureau of Investigation. The summary report not only involved Castillo in the assassination of John Kennedy, it disclosed that Castillo was a hypno-programmed zombie who would kill on cue. The summary report stated, quote, "The zombie phenomenon referred to here is a somnambulistic behavior displayed by the subject in a conditioned response to a series of words, phrases, and statements apparently unknown to the subject during his normal waking state. While under the influence of such a zombie state, the subject closed his eyes, rose bodily, walked, triggered a pistol, stared blankly, and fell to the floor with no apparent sense of physical pain. As far as could be determined experimentally, the zombie behavior had for its objective the assassination of President Ferdinand Marcos of the Republic of the Philippines," unquote. The report also stated, quote, "Neither the presence nor the discovery of the zombie states in our subject should be regarded as noble or unique. If anything, the only remarkable character of the zombie state in our subject is its deeply ingrained and systematic presentation, indicating a certain disturbing degree of conditioning." Note that phrase, a disturbing degree of conditioning. In a lengthy summary, the NBI hypnotist and deprogrammer of Castillo recounted the details of exactly how he had uncovered the key that unlocked the programmed assassin's mind. The letters XBGUMIDUTYBX were found scribbled on the white surface of a cigarette package which was in Castillo's possession at the time of his arrest. The paper had been folded carefully and tucked into the back of his watch. Castillo had told investigators that this piece of paper was given him by a man named Luis Mauricio. Castillo said that Mauricio also gave him money. Mauricio was known to the NBI as a member of the Huck Guerrillas. Placing Castillo in a trance, the hypnotist called out the series of letters on the cigarette package. Castillo did not react. He then tried calling out the letters, pausing at different places. He found that when he paused between the G and the U, saying XBG, comma, a pause, UMIDUTYBX, Castillo would reply with, "I am myself to kill," unquote. The hypnotist then tried the letters one at a time, and then in different combinations. While many of the combinations produced no response, the following were significant. When the hypnotist said X, unquote, Castillo quickly answered Mauricio, unquote. When the hypnotist said BGU, Castillo slowly said, "I am myself," unquote. When the hypnotist said MI, Castillo answered, "To kill," unquote. In another session, the hypnotist experimented with saying Luis Castillo as a command. The hypnotist reported, quote, "A pathetic sight takes place after this. The subject turns his pistol to his own temple and squeezes the trigger as many times as his name is repeated." Whenever the hypnotist would say, quote, "June 12, 1967, 12 o'clock, June 22, 1967, July 4, 1967, or January 1, 1968, Castillo would invariably aim the pistol and squeeze the trigger. The hypnotist found that after the preparatory command to put him in a trace, If Castillo's eyes were open and he saw a photograph of President Marcos, he would, with no verbal instructions, aim and repeatedly squeeze the trigger of his pistol, following the photo wherever it was taken around the room. If the hypnotist said the word kill while Castillo was following this program, he would drop heavily to the floor and remain motionless. The hypnotist's report also includes Castillo's amazing story about his participation in yet another organized assassination attempt. Under hypnosis, Castillo said that the assassination had happened before noon, unquote. He remembered being with a man called Lake, unquote, whom he described as a tall man weighing about 190 pounds, with a hawk-like nose, black hair, and oriental eyes set in a long face. Lake spoke with a foreign accent which Castillo could not identify. He said that he remembered meeting Lake along with four or five other men in an airport. They then drove together in a black car to a building. Castillo said that he thought the group included both Americans and foreigners, and he thought one man was Spanish.
Continuing. When the group arrived at the building, Castillo said they climbed to a second floor room, which he described after some uncertainty as brown. The room contained packing crates, a short brown table, a typewriter, and two, quote, lift-up glass windows overlooking a street. Lake opened a black suitcase, which Castillo described as a bowling bag with a zipper and lock. It contained a scope and pieces of a rifle, which Lake assembled. He set the scope at 500 yards and gave the rifle to Castillo. Castillo did not seem certain about the make or caliber of the rifle, but finally said that he thought it was Russian. Lake told him to shoot a man in the back seat of an open car in the middle of the caravan. He said that the man would be seated with a lady or another man. A mirror was to be flashed twice from a building across the street, so that Castillo would know when he was to shoot. When he saw the two flashes, he was supposed to shoot at the next car coming into view. When he was questioned about the identity of the man riding in the open car, Castillo said that he did not know who the victim was. After Lake had assembled the rifle and had given Castillo his instructions, he went downstairs. Later, Lake rushed into the room. Quote, "They got him already," Lake told him. "Let's get out of here." He then grabbed the rifle away from Castillo, dismantled it and stuffed it and the scope into the black bag. Castillo and Lake rushed downstairs, got into a car with two other men, and drove away from the building. They picked up a bald-headed, skinny man after they turned the first corner. Three or four blocks later, the car stopped and picked up another man. Castillo said he was riding in the back seat between Lake and the man who had joined them at the second stop. As the car drove away from the scene of the crime, the unidentified man gave Castillo an injection while he wasn't looking. He went immediately to sleep and woke up in a Chicago hotel room with Mrs. Krepps. He and Mrs. Krepps got into a blue car and drove to Milwaukee, Castillo said. While driving there, they heard the news of the assassination of John F. Kennedy on the car radio. Within a few days after the hypnotist submitted his final report, Castillo was out of the NBI jail and had left the Philippines for parts unknown. It was later uncovered that Castillo was returned to the United States in 1967 and questioned by the FBI, whose spokesman said, quote, "We talked to Castillo and he told us that he'd fabricated his story about the Kennedy assassination, said he'd made it up in Manila." The official record says that Castillo was sentenced to 6 years in the Missouri Penitentiary for robbery in June 1971. On August 1, 1974, he was released after serving 37 months. Castillo's last known contact was with his mother shortly after his release from prison. Since then, he has disappeared from both his family and those researchers who would like to question him further. If Castillo had indeed made it up in Manila, as the FBI spokesman claimed, then he would have had to have had a phenomenal memory, an incredibly high tolerance to sodium amytal and alcohol, and virtuoso acting ability. Neither the psychological profile nor the life history of Luis Angel Castillo supports the conclusion that he possessed any of these talents.
Again, those excerpts from the book Operation Mind Control by Walter Borish and from AFA program number 5. Of course, in addition to my own voice, you also heard the voice of my brilliant and charming former co-host, Nip Tuck, whose on-air abilities were fundamental to the successful execution of the AFA programs. This concludes For the Record program number 974, Operation Mind Control Part 1, Programming the Perfect Killer. This is being recorded on September 4th of the year 2017. I'm Dave Emery. Have fun.